Thanks very much, Ben, for that very nice welcome. I was on my way down here in the car, and I knew I'd get lost as I hit the city. So I had this sat-nav thing on, and hence I was the one who suggested sat-nav. An act of mild sabotage, but you really did rise to the challenge. But anyway, the very nice English lady on the sat-nav began to talk to me on the Naas Road about a place called Luinneach, which I'd never heard of before. So Luinneach came up over and over again. I began to think, there's a place I know called Limerick, whose name in Irish is Limnach. And I began to think, wouldn't it be great, you know, there's a poetic form called the Limerick, if we had a thing called the Luinneach. what would a Luinneach be like? So as I distracted myself in the car, I thought maybe it would be exactly like a Limerick, only it would be about getting lost somewhere. And you'd have to pronounce, it would must also have mentioned Irish place names, but said the way someone who didn't speak Irish would pronounce it. So in that case, I began to think then, I got lost a bit. And this is actually true, this is really true. I started to make up a Luinneach as I drove down. And it went something like this. And there was a young poet from Athcleath. The sat-nav was very weird. That's not a great rhyme. He said, take me to Cork before it gets dark. And at that very moment, the police camera flashed on the left. This is true, I got penalty points. That actually happened. So I never got to invent the last line of the Luinneach.
Great concept.
So after all that lightness, now for the darkness, unfortunately. I'm going to read a few poems from the first book, and I'll start with a poem called Accolades in the Afternoon. And I wrote this poem a few years ago. I used to do a lot of martial arts. And so I had lots of disc problems from wrestling and karate and everything. But eventually I damaged something in my lower back, and I ended up not able to walk for 12 months, and I got really fed up. This poem is about that. It's about sitting at home and not being able to go for a walk, and, you know, watching the countdown and stuff like that. You know? So it's called Accolades in the Afternoon. I no longer walk by the butcher greed margins, pick devil's bit scabious, red clover or yarrow. And having no cure for anyone, least of all myself, I live content in the knowledge that tomorrow I will be one day older, and if not wiser, I will at least have kept my grip on the remote control and avoided, so far so good, the fatal ankle shot that's set to come my way. And no amount of cold comfort from Oprah, Dr. Phil or Geraldo can alter the fact that I have mislaid my armour, lost my spear and helmet. I'm dumbfounded by the glinting treasures of all night shopping channels, the hokey melodrama of Australian soap operas, golden oldies and whodunits. I sleep soundly, never dreaming of sieges, warring city-states, recalcitrant satraps, long marches or voyages. But sometimes during an ad-break and countdown, I wrestle the tea-time teaser until my kettle boils over. And squinting in the blinding Trojan sun, I step once more into the hellish mist where Hector lies slain against the wheel of a Greek war chariot. I lash his feet on with my dressing gown rope, take the reins and set off. All Troy watches my victory lap. 9 times the sun will rise before I stop. The second poem that I'm going to read, I don't know which, sorry, I keep walking away from the mic. The second poem, everybody knows that the weather forecast on Radio 4, it's almost poetic to hear the names of all those different sea zones. And of course, on the radio that I have, often the reception is terribly bad. And instead of hearing the actual names of these regions, they come out slightly distorted, and this poem is about that, and it's called Weather Report. Live in hope, Someday you'll get a reception you deserve, a signal you are fully in tune to a once-in-a-lifetime wavelength of unmatched clarity. But until then, make do with misunderstandings, botched connections, mistaken beliefs, and the inevitable outcomes of hasty sends and deletes. Listen up for the long-range forecast heard through an argument, the lifelong fading hiss of an undetectable truth, as you navigate the waters of another stormy night, across the shipping lanes of lovers you deceived. Hunger, fans, boulder, maidenhead, fissure, firmantite, Sunday bastard, cuckold, sinister. The next poem. The next poem is called Harvest, and it's really, I suppose, a love poem about how sometimes you can go your separate ways and it doesn't work out, and there's no really going back after, but you can think of, sit around and yearning for the person who isn't there anymore. And it's called Harvest. All these years I've waited like a gift for you, but it's too late now, you'll never come. So I'll drink alone in the Kruskian lawn, my window keeled in the July rain. That carillon I hear is not the music of bells, but the sound of a blade delicately folded over and beaten until every breath of impurity is expelled and only the ringing integrity of hardness remains. Yet when the door taps gently in the breeze, I look up hoping in vain to see your face, remembering our perfected antinomies and the gorgeous mistakes we gladly made. Now death waits patiently for our dumb compliance, kindling a smooth brown jar for our ashes. But we're not like those who would soon go quietly. We'll take our shelter in the eye of the burning sun. Thanks. This next poem is about I don't know, for anyone who has a son, I remember when I was growing up, my father would try to talk to me about things, and I never wanted to talk to him about the things he was trying to talk to me about. I don't know if it improved much, but it wasn't great when I was growing up. He asked me about something, and I said, what? You know? And the same thing happened exactly with my own son, who was in his mid-20s. And the two of us were sitting in the room late one night, and he was reading the Herald, the Evening Herald up in Dublin. And a programme was on the TV later with Jules Holland. And the band that was on at the time, I was trying to talk to him about anything, but he was having absolutely none of it, you know. But the band that was on at the time was, it was Chris Barber, and John will appreciate this, who was playing magnificent trombone. And oddly enough, he had this singer from the 70s and 80s who's in Eric Clapton's band, I think now Andy Fairweather, go. And he was playing this Burns electric guitar, and I'm into all those old instruments, and I was saying to myself, look at that, that's a Burns electric guitar. He was going to read the paper, you know. They just didn't want to know, and I really could see that I was in the exact same spot that my poor father was with me all those years before. And the other part of this poem, without going on too much about it, I grew up in Stony Batter, which is in the north inner city in Dublin. And there used to be a guy who went around with a horse and cart, and he'd collect all the slops from the houses. And believe it or not, in the north inner city, there were several pig farms one time.
Acts of fortune.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but he used to go around collecting the stuff. But we used to think, you know, if you'd seen a film like Ben Hur, this was the nearest thing to a chariot you would ever see, you know. So, the poem is called Riding with the Pigman After Later with Jules. So here goes, son. Breathe. No pressure. Speak now. I say the black guitar is a Burns and the band is Chris Barber's, fronted by Andy Fairweather Lowe. I've gambled on this late night music programme, hoping you'll put down your paper and we'll talk, though lately all I say seems forced and false. True to form, you know the odds, your fractured glance withheld as I persist unchastened on the difference between the baritone and tenor sax, knowing I have vexed you when you say you want to read your paper, and I should relent and put away my candid soul. My slim hope we might for once parole our hearts, unlock this silence, our bone-deep vastness, that someday soon were you free to listen. I might tell you with a father's strange compulsion, why I see great beauty in an old guitar, a Strat, a Burns, a Gretsch White Falcon. Or I might tell you about the time I rode with the pig man from Stony Batter to Ashford Street, filling rusty oil drums on his carpet with scraps and skins. The slops of steely women in blue housecoats, whose back for look on roadside coal they found, and whose artisans' houses, perpetually lit by the crimson glow of Sacred Heart lamps, stank of smoke and boiling cabbage, and the undertow of faith and rabbit myth. And if you are free to listen, I might tell you about the time I worked in a bar in Stony Batter. A night I walked home in a bone-freezing wind, passing a drunk who was beating his wife. He slammed her head on the door of his car, and though only a skitter, I told that waster to leave her alone. And leave her he did, shouting she was only a whore, and when he caught me, he'd milk me and leave me for dead. And I might tell you, if you're free to listen, about a night near Christmas, coming home from a shift in the pub, I found an injured dog lying on the Cabra Road. He lay on the curb, his back broken, his dry tongue lolling in the stank. I fed him the last of my fish and chips, watching him die in mongrel death, not knowing that years later, having stopped for a dog on the same street, I would drive past my own father as he sheltered in a doorway from the wind and rain after a session in Walsh's, his clothes too smoky and wet, his bladder too vexing for me. But can you picture this? I imagine warm conversations, overdue kisses, an impossible embrace, his baffled forgiveness for passing that day. I still cruise those streets hoping to find him again, his bus yet to come, his unsteady presence unyielding in the rain. Thanks. As they say, now for something completely different. If Matthew Sweeney was here, he is the master of this type of poem, there's absolutely no question about it. But this poem was called Donnie Darwin's Dog. He trained his mastiff to walk upright like a man, dressed him in a white t-shirt, blue parallels, blood-red Doc Martens laced to the hocks. At home games, they were a shed-end fixture, mixing with the visitors, distant booth, tooth and nail. But then the new romantics arrived on the scene, and the dog was all rolled up sleeves and shoulder pads, all fluff and fainous, and hiding his basso profundo bark. He gave up raw meat and whined for bone-shaped biscuits. Out went the Old Spice and the Brute, and the hard stare and the Molossian walk. He refused the spike collar and the choke chain, and read the red tops back to front, front to back even. He went to the library for peace and quiet, Baudelaire and Oscar Wilde. At the same time, Donnie's arms went from short and thick to long and hairy, his voice from growl to grunt. He let his hair grow and refused to shave. Inexplicably, the dog began to laugh before the punchline when he told the joke. Worst of all, he preferred disco and salsa to ska. But the dog didn't have it all his own way, and when the man in the van came, he knew his number was up. For a week in the pound, he shared a bay with a she-wolf cross and a Japanese Tosa. They agreed to disagree on Baudelaire and Wilde, but he nagged them for 6 days and nights, and on the seventh day they relented and joined him, slipping and slobbering in a passable rendition of Saturday Night Fever. The vet couldn't believe her eyes. Donnie, never missing him, smashed all his records and burned all his clothes. From then on, he lived on nuts and bananas, which he cracked and peeled with his toes. Thanks. Well, as I mentioned, I come from an area called Stony Batter, and there used to be a very large cattle market there. And every week, when I was a kid growing up, it was the biggest livestock market in Europe, and they used to literally 7,000 cows and 6,000 sheep and 5,000 pigs. Don't ask me why there were that numbers, but there was every single week. Marched literally through the streets in the area where I was, from the trucks up to the cattle market. And so this poem is called Where the Brown River Flows. So I'll leave it to your imagination what the Brown River is. Here they come, the Frisians and Charolais, the large whites and land races, down Oxman Town, down Ockham Street, Ross Street, Ashford and Arklow Street. They run the rivulets of Dun turning to rivers on Ben Eder and Niall Street. The Crombie drovers calling and shouting, their ash plants strafing poles and bleeding haunches. Fear and a strange exhilaration everywhere, where on market day, when children crush in doorways and alcoves, well used to but wary of the thundering hooves and the sudden grunt of diesel engines. Here they come, the blessed of the country, the cattle ranchers and farmers, the dealers and the flush books in money-chopped boots. Here they come, the spit on the handmen, the blowers and puffers, the gombeans and sharps. They come, and beasts bellow in the slaughter races, and rams clang on the pavements, and sticks jangle the drains of the grills and hollow rails, and they turn in a ring of churning dust, where the auctioneer yammers the bids, and farmers pummel rosettes of money. And still they come until the blood drains from the killing floor, the foundations drop, and Drumalee Estate slides over the cattle pens and abattoir. The stench and crop of carcass lingering for years. And now they are gone. 117 years of gore and slaughter, a holocaust of beasts. 10,000 hecatombs drained to the bones, trotters and hooves, skull hummed and cropped. The slung cords of hooked meat, put clean as the torsos of mannequins. They came and they're gone. The cattle trucks, the glazed eyes that bulged between the slats. The tanglers, drovers and penny boys gone. The school boat and the Brown River gone. The greatcoats pressed, the boots polished, the streets washed clean, all of it gone. Everything put away or covered over. This is civilization. This is how it is. Next poem, I had the misfortune one time to read this poem in a place where there was a big fire lit behind me, and as I read the poem I could feel myself, it was very in keeping with the poem because I literally felt I was being cooked as I read the poem. But the poem was called Petronilla de Meath, and Petronilla de Meath was the first so-called heretic to be born in either Ireland or in England in the 14th century. And she really was a scapegoat. It was her. She was the lady in waiting, and it was the lady, in fact, who was the real criminal. But they incriminated her, and they gave her a terrible death. And so I wrote lots of poems about scapegoats. This one is about Petronilla de Meath, and there's a very famous artwork that you can see online, and it's I've actually forgotten the name of it, but Petronilla de Meath. It's a dinner setting for 19 famous women, and Petronilla de Meath is one of the play settings, you know, and each play setting has artifacts that relate to the life of that person. Anyway, Petronilla de Meath. The flaying seconds go as all time goes, and going slowly on the inches and miles go, and so the journey to my dying goes, slow and hard and halt its length and time go. And the inch of time builds in the slow miles I have walked for days, whipped and flayed through six godly parishes to a kindling where the living fire is mine. And the seconds candling my hot breath born centuries down inches of miles to my confession. Three ways I born, yet still I live, and my brightness goes down in second breath an inch into Lord Ossory's fire, to meet like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, death the fourth and last. The King of Fire. And this poem, when I was was a kid, I was telling John at the counter there, I had this notion that I'd be a writer when I grew up. God knows why I had this. And I thought, I have to read all the really hard books. So I remember finding out that Charles Dickens was very hard. I was probably about 8 or 9 at the time, and I'd have to read all his books before I could ever learn how to write anything. So, and I've done other ones as well, but it was at that time when those editions were out where the writing was absolutely tiny, you know. I used to think, how am I ever going to finish this? And I actually did finish Around the World in 80 Days, and, you know, I was ready to call it a day. But I used to write little poems on bits of paper I find around the place. And one time, God knows why, I wrote a poem on the inside of a cigarette packet, which my mother found. And she literally chased me around the house with this piece of paper, telling me that this was a great thing. Not that it was a great poem, but that it was a great thing that I had written a poem, and she recognised it was a poem. And I ran all around the house trying to escape from her. And eventually I was under the bed with my arms crossed like a dead body, you know. I was shouting over the bed at me, John, come out, the poem, oh, yeah. It was really good. And it actually terrified me because I didn't want any of this attention or praise, whatever. You know, I knew this was a bad thing, and whatever it was that I did, I wasn't going to do it again for a long time. So this is about that. And then years later, at the time I was working for IBM, and I used to be all going all over the place. And I remember one time being really fed up and sitting in Heathrow, it might have been, at about 5:30 in the morning, and sitting there with the boarding pass in my hand. And I started to just scribble a couple of lines, you know, and before I knew where I was writing a poem again. But this was at least 20 years after the first time. And then, after another series of fits and starts, I wrote a poem about the two of those experiences of writing this poem. And of course, the second poem was actually about my mother, and I don't know what was in it even at the time, right? But the poem is called As If She Were Close. My mother is chasing me all over the house. No, this is not a nightmare. It happened 40 or so years ago. She is waving an empty cigarette packet I'd neatly opened to expose a writing surface. This is where I wrote my first poem, a knot of gritty phrases about a battle in Vietnam or Iwo Jima. I can't remember where, but I dropped it or thrown it away and forgotten about it. My spider pencil crawl of a treatment, a Sunday afternooner, a black and whiter, the kind my mother liked as long as Garfield or Cagney starred. But my poem has no stars. Just a bloodless jungle of men killing each other in childish, thrilling ways. She finally catches me, arms crossed like a corpse under her bed. John, it's very good. You wrote a poem. I'm 7 or 8 years old, and I know whatever the thing I've done, it has a power to frighten, a frightening power. One to shunt aside until years after she's dead, where I find myself in the departure lounge at Heathrow, waiting to connect, as my American bosses say. My slim ticket ready in my hand, and hours to kill before boarding. And it begins again, a full 30 years since I nipped it in the bud, as if she were close. I'm writing a poem about my mother in the space on the back of the card. Something very simple about us walking along the quays on the long way home from the auction she used to love. It's straightforward, honest, plain. But there's a powerful feeling too, like my heart is physically moving to the wrong side of my chest, where it should not be. And the bloody thing makes me cry. God damn it, but I can't stop writing it now. I keep going on with it, on and on. What else can I do? I had this order in my head that I would read certain poems, but I've begun to change it as I go along. There's quite a few poems in the second book about just it's hard to live in Ireland and not to know somebody who has some problem or addiction of some kind. I know lots of them. And they're great friends of mine, and especially the people who've recovered it, probably the most interesting people I know. Live very intensely, you know. And some of the poems I've written, it's almost like an act of, I feel like, I hope it is anyway, an act of solidarity. It's almost like they're being reborn, you know, in some way. And this poem is called Midwintry. There was light enough on that cold and drowning day, but no shaft of gold lit our stumbling passageway of holy streets and lanes. We knew it all and brooked no Kyrie eleison or klaxon warning call. On forgotten roads, we abandoned everything we loved and spiked the past with the flags of our convenient histories. We threw our load of dice against the stars and played games with glorious mysteries. Our luck ran out in 1,000 bars. From ordinary liaisons in ordinary time, we escaped the drunk tank of reason and then broke in again to our accepted season, naked and sublime. No downpour washed our guilt away, but a thin light sang like a crucifix in the wind when we stormed the breach of God's dark mind, kept our sunlit sails, left our madness behind. This poem is called The Nod. My wife's people are from a place called Cave Town in Roscommon, and it really is very remote, and there's a big lake outside the front of the house. And in fact, the lake, the women who are walking on the front of this book are walking beside Cave Town Lake. That's my daughter, that's my wife, that's my wife's mother, that's my wife's mother's mother, and that's my daughter's daughter at the top. There's five generations of. And the reason the book is called The Language Hospital is because language is, I think, is reclaimed in communities and places like this, you know, in Cork and in Dublin and every little community around the country, you know. And all the assholes on the radio who keep telling us, you know, from the MBA madrasas that have ruined the country, you know, that they're turning ideas into impacts, that actually makes me want to throw the window, throw the window out of the radio. I'm going to throw the radio out of the window.
Oh, you were right
in the first place. But anyhow, it's about a conversation I had with my wife's grandfather. At the time, I was about 25 or 26 and had two small kids. But he was 86. He was a full 60 years older than me. And all the women in the house went to town, and we sat there on each side of the range with him smoking his pipe. And over 3 hours, there was one conversation with literally two sentences and one gesture. And this is the story of that, what happened there. So it's called The Nod, and it's about Cave Town Lake. Tonight the lights of the new bungalows dance in the level water of the lake, and shadows from Jimmy the Hayes shack and your grandfather's derelict house squat behind the wall of shoreline trees where Mick Cassery's boat has collapsed in the bones of its timbers. For years now, the fishing has been poor, the brown trout almost gone, driven out, your cousin says, by pike introduced by coarse men with no patience for fly fishing in famine days, when every fly is the wrong fly and teasing wood jump clear of the water, throwing sprays of diamonds off their backs. The lake water is ice cold, the shock of it enough to stall the heart of a sick man, though when I was younger I often swam and catching crayfish in a clear jar for our children, or wading out to catch voracious shrimp, to watch voracious shrimp feed among the reeds and afterwards drying off in minutes in the windless heat of an August afternoon. I'll never swim again, never run as I once did at full tilt across an open field, unafraid of the limits of my endurance. And I'll never again stand for profligate hours mindless in the heaven of the passing world around me. What was that world? A dust-lit kitchen 25 years ago with a range and a wooden table on which two pairs touch end-to-end in a semblance of homely infinity. A Bakelite telephone encrusted with peat moats from the range where each night your grandmother heats iron blocks and wraps them in a blanket to warm the bed we sleep in. A two-station TV to watch news and weather bulletins twice a day. And the only comfortable chairs in the house, each side of the range, one for your grandfather, the other for guests. A few months before he dies in his chair, Mick scrapes out his pipe and fills it. There's little or no talk while the women are abroad in the town. Outside the window, the lake is frosted silver by multitudes of small pointed waves. A crow on the roof coughs a raucous bell. We settle down and for 2 hours no car passes. The only sound is our breathing and a popping noise when Mick draws on his pipe. Are you shaving yet? Is the sum of his talk. I'm 26 years old, a father myself. Though to your grandfather, I'm still a child. I am, I answered, the remainder unsaid. A post office van glides by on the road, breaching the air as if its engine were dead. The wireless turned low all morning, crackles a line from a Shannon song. The fridge shivers in a vain attempt to keep weak old milk from taint. Tappets yammer in the backfield where a tractor idles in neutral. The clock on the hall ticks and chirps like a broken banjo. Steps on the gravel, voices at the door. Coming and going, a notion to go up to the bedroom and look out at the lake field where the malt bull sleeps. 5 full minutes pass before he gives me the nod. Thanks very much.